Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. At UCLA, this is Black Bruin Welcome Week. But some fraternity and sorority members are accused of mocking black culture. On Tuesday night, men from Sigma Phi Epsilon and women belonging to Alpha Phi reportedly wore blackface to a party themed around the rap artist Kanye West. Law professor Jerry Kang is vice chancellor for equity, diversity, and inclusion at UCLA. That's a new job. Good to have you on our program.
It's a pleasure to be here. Longtime listener. Didn't know I would engage on these terms, though.
Well, you get this kind of job, and that's what happens to you.
Excellent. Yeah.
So the facts I just reported, brief as they were, I got from a Los Angeles Times report. Is that correct?
I think that's correct. The allegation, of course, is whether or not it was actually blackface. It could be, as some students have described it, as nearly blackface. Mm-hmm. And I think the problem was that even though it was spoofing a particular popular icon, Kanye West, it turned into what appeared to be a license to actually trot out numerous black stereotypes, including images and performances that are not necessarily Kanye West.
What images, what performances?
So the images that I've seen, and they're widely circulating on social media, include, again, you know, whether it's women with dirty faces because they're supposedly gold diggers, which is a song that Kanye West has made quite famous, or people wearing what would be called thug life clothing with caps and jeans and other kinds of performances that, on the one hand, you know, a person from the outside world might just say, look, they're just playing with culture. Of course, everyone's playing with popular culture in this kind of way. It's not that big of a deal. But what I want to try to emphasize again is, again, we're all part of a family. And the example that I want to change, I want to give just a different example that might help listeners understand what's going on. If, you know, everyone knows this song Gangnam Style. If I see someone dancing and they're riding an imaginary horse with their arms in some cross grip, I know they're making fun of a particular style, Gangnam Style, by a Korean artist. That's one thing. But if you start at a party switching to slanty eye gestures, that's something different. If you come dressed up as a kung fu master because it was supposed to be a Gangnam Style party based on the rapper Psy, but then you take it to another level to perform a certain kind of, again, minstrelsy, then you should know at the least that other members of your family, and Bruins are a family in some sense, will feel deeply hurt. The only other point that I want to add is that context matters. We've had a long and hard summer. It's a summer of pain, of blood, of discontent, where Black Lives Matter meant something, and that's why I agree that Black Bruins Matter is something that we should emphasize. That in that context, you have the judgment or lack of judgment to throw a party in which you would invite this kind of behavior, especially in the first couple of weeks of school, is the kind of thing that I think ought to be condemned.
I have seen pictures indicating that there are very large protests going on, or have been today, at the on the campus. I have a picture of a young African-American woman holding a sign that says, "Stop the mockery of our culture, hashtag Black Bruins Matter." So are they justified in their concerns?
So, you know, I went to that rally. I addressed it impromptu. I think it's a serious question. Look, again, I know you have a very sophisticated audience, and people will ask, well, who owns culture? What are the limits of being able to change culture, play with culture, challenge authenticity? And, of course, as a fancy academic, we can talk post-cultural discourse in a whole bunch of ways. But I think it's important to just kind of break it down into a more sort of concrete, you know, face-to-face personal level. We're all members of a large family here, and when new students come on campus after a context that was actually pretty difficult over the summer, people want to feel like they belong. And that's the thing, I think, when people misuse culture or go to places that you know will cause pain and mistrust, that's the kind of judgment that I want to remind people might not be the judgment they intended. And also, did not even seek, in which case then we've got to check ourselves and our behaviors.
Will there be, should there be, some kind of accountability, some sort of disciplinary action?
Yeah. So I think, look, my office was created, and it's a brand new office of equity, diversity, and inclusion. It was created just in July of 2015 to deal with not only these matters, but also questions about discrimination against faculty and staff members. And I am keenly interested in promoting accountability. And so you should know that there has been already an interim suspension of social activities for both the fraternity and the sorority involved. We are carefully investigating exactly what happened. As a lawyer and as someone who's committed both to procedural due process as well as different forms of cultural and academic freedom, I want to make sure that we get the facts right. But if there is a violation of university policy, then that's something that the university could take into account. Regardless of any of that, just as it might be in anyone's rights to engage in some cultural performance, it's also in anyone's rights who has heard that performance to yell loudly in social media as well as face-to-face that that performance upset them, did not interest them, stigmatized them. And that's exactly what we saw today. So to the extent that people celebrate freedom of speech, we had that just today.
We're almost out of time, but you say that UCLA is a family. Only 4% of the undergraduates on the campus are African Americans. Do they feel they're not part of the family?
To be entirely honest, I think that's right. And when they run into this kind of activity, especially in the first couple of weeks, if you're a freshman suddenly going to a place that has, you know, tens of thousands of students, of course, at that numerical minority status, people are going to feel a little isolated, a little out of place. And to be honest, even though maybe I shouldn't say it, I think a lot of African-American students do feel like they're not entirely included in the family. But what I want to underscore as being extremely important is that we are trying to change that desperately. There are lots of people who care, and I know people ought to be skeptical, and people are challenging whether UCLA or the administration really cares.
Okay.
But I want to convey that I care, and I represent, at least in part, UCLA.
Jerry Kong, again, a law professor, also now Vice Chancellor for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion at UCLA. Many thanks.
Thank you very much.
In a moment, is the LAPD overreacting to a hostile atmosphere? That's on Which Way LA.
Visit the Which Way LA blog for an extension of what Los Angeles is made of. News, arts, culture, and the fabric of Southern California, all in one place and updated daily. Check it out now at kcrw.com/whichwayla.
Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. Last Saturday night, two officers of the LAPD shot and killed a man in Van Nuys after the black window of their patrol car was broken out by a beer bottle. The man was unarmed, but he has not been identified. The officer's attorney says they rightfully feared for their lives because of a video that they were shown at roll call. Chief Charlie Beck initially said the video represented a possible threat. Now he says it did not. The editorial board of the LA Times says a lot of questions still need to be answered. Mariel Garza is an editorial writer. Hi, Mariel. Good to have you back on our program.
Hi, Warren.
I guess the first of these questions would be, who was the man who was killed?
That is exactly right. We still don't know very much about him at all. And there are a whole other host of questions that need to be answered. One was answered by the chief to a certain extent this week, and that was what were officers thinking that night? And we were told about the video, and that made them worried that they would be attacked.
What about whether the man threw the bottle or not? Wouldn't that be important?
Oh yeah, that's an important one too. Good question. And there are a whole host of ones after that as well. The bottle, what other things made the officers believe they were in danger? Is that protocol to leave your vehicle and shoot in that kind of circumstances? You know, we have no doubt that that there are some good explanations out there. We'd just like to hear them.
So the chief hasn't really been very forthcoming about this. He said that the officers appeared to be fearful of their lives, as their attorney has said, because of the video. But now he says the video didn't really represent a threat. Tell us about the video.
Well, I only know as much as you do and other members of the public. It was a very short 15-second video that, according to the LAPD, was some sort of promotional video that had been filmed by members of a 1990s rap group that was trying to make a comeback. And in the video, there's a grainy shot of a police officer, or rather a police car, through the windshield of some other vehicle. And then the camera pans down to a big gun in somebody's lap, and they put it under a shirt. That was it. On Tuesday, LAPD released a little more information about the video, saying that they had that detectives had determined that it was made for entertainment purposes and not a credible threat. They're still pursuing, and they have arrested, I believe, at least one person for having a firearm in a car. That's all we know. If I had seen that out of context and as an officer, I might be a little freaked out.
Mariel Garza, once again, editorial writer at the Los Angeles Times. Craig Lawley is with us. He's president of the Los Angeles Police Protective League, which bargains for most rank-and-file officers of the LAPD. Officer Lawley, good to have you back on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be back, Warren.
So it's important for our listeners to realize here that the officers saw this video on Saturday morning, as I understand it, at roll call. I guess everybody did. And then on Saturday night, this incident occurred. Do you believe that they were right to be in fear of their lives?
Oh, absolutely. First of all, I've been in that situation before. About 32 years ago, I was actually ambushed, and the back of my police vehicle, the windows were blown out from a gun they were shooting at us. And I was actually been in that situation, so I know it can happen.
Is it, though, important for the department to tell us more about what actually took place and whether, in fact, the man who was shot was the one who threw the bottle?
Well, yeah, the department will eventually come out. But, you know, these investigations are long investigations. They're investigated by not only the L.A. Police Department. They're investigated by the Inspector General's office. They're also investigated by the Jackie Lacey's office, the District Attorney's office. So there's going to be more than one investigation going. And so I understand why the chief or the department does not release a lot of the details right now. And I don't have any control of that. I really haven't. I'm sure the investigation is still ongoing. So I understand the apprehension about releasing, actually releasing any kind of information.
What about the fact that apparently the department made a mistake about the video? It wasn't really intended to be threatening to the LAPD. It was just some kind of promotion.
Well, the fact, you know, my understanding is the guy made the statement after he got arrested. So really, do we really know that that's really why he followed officers? I think we can all agree that the guy that did that videotape and had a gun in the car and followed the LAPD officers is an idiot.
Real officer in the video. That's not faked.
No, that's a real officer.
Okay.
And so we can all agree that he's an idiot for doing something like that, like even tailing a L.A. police car. So that is indisputable. And what's really could have happened was, you know, what if the officer would have noticed that they were being followed and maybe did a vehicle stop on this guy and he had a gun in the car, and then who knows what would have happened after that? He may have even gotten shot. So that wouldn't have been a good thing.
Okay. Once again, we don't know when the video was shot or under what circumstances. The chief now says it wasn't really a threat. But Craig Lawley, you say that the officers nonetheless were right to assume it was.
Absolutely. I think anybody would assume it's a threat. Why? You know, like I said, I got 35 years on this job, and it's very rare that an officer is tailed. I've only known of one other situation that a person has been tailed on this job. It was Detective Williams when he was tailed in North Hollywood picking up his kid from a daycare center, and he actually was assassinated with his 8-year-old kid in the car. So I know people have tailed officers in the past. I don't know what his intentions are. I know he made a statement now, but you know what? Who knows what his real intentions were, because I haven't talked to the guy, and maybe he didn't think he was going to get caught.
Craig Lawley, once again, the president of the Los Angeles Police Protective League. Jody Armour is with us. He is a law professor at USC and a student of police relationships. with the public. Thanks very much for being on our program.
Good to be with you, Warren.
What do you make of all this?
Well, I think one thing, Warren, this shows is the pernicious effect of exaggerating threats faced by law enforcement, because this was a false threat in the form of this video. That's not to say, as the prior speaker said, Craig, that it wasn't a reason for concern. I would have been concerned, too, if I were wearing a uniform. But when cops are constantly told that they're under constant fire, that every interaction with a citizen could be their last, or that they're fortunate each time they come home from a job in one piece, it's poison for police-community relationships. It puts police in a combative mindset, it isolates them from the community, and it generates these kinds of risks. And the real problem is it's a false narrative. So far, 2015 is on pace with the 35 felonious killings of police officers to be one of the safest in history, 2013 in the last 50 years, 2013 being safer. But if this pace holds, this year would end up being the second lowest number of murdered cops in decades. So there's a false narrative out there that there's a war on cops, and that's putting a lot, that's having a very pernicious effect on the morale of police officers themselves.
That number you used is a national number, right? Not
yes.
A local number.
Oh, absolutely. These are national numbers.
I think it's pretty important to make that.
Oh,
that point. We're also heard told, though, often that many police officers go through an entire career without ever taking their guns out of their holsters.
Oh, yeah, and that's an important message to get across to the rank and file, too, that it makes for a miserable work life if you're trained to think your job is getting progressively more dangerous, that a significant percentage of people you encounter daily are looking to do you harm. You're going to constantly be on guard, on edge, and jumpy and all the like. It's a state of mind that's ruled by the limbic system rather than the frontal lobe. And so just to attract more good people to the police force, we need to combat that false narrative.
So, Craig Lawley, what do you say to that? Is it or is it not a false narrative?
Well, first of all, I don't know where he gets the statistics nationwide. I just know in the city of Los Angeles, assaults on police officers are up, I think, 18% to 20%. That's fact, because the district attorney looks at those cases, either files charges or doesn't. So that's a fact. The assault, and I'm not talking about killing police officers. I'm talking about assaults on police officers are up 18% to 20% since the first of the year. So that's a fact. Number two is it's usually the small amount of people making the most noise. There was a recent Gallup poll that came out, and there was confidence across the United States. Who are they most confident in as far as lines of work? Number one is the military by far. Number two is, and this poll came out about 2 weeks ago, number two is small business. And number three is police. So if there's such a rhetoric going around the country that police are out of control, they're brutal, how come we're number three in a Gallup poll that just came out 2 weeks ago, even with Ferguson involved? So the real numbers are just do polls across the country, and you'll see the police are still very high esteem with everybody, with the vast majority of people throughout the country.
So, Professor Armour, are you exaggerating in the other direction?
Well, the numbers that I cited, you come from Radley Balco, who's done a lot of great work for the Washington Post on this, and you know, men lie, women lie, numbers don't. You can just check the numbers, and this is from the safety standpoint. Fatal encounters, one of the lowest, although Craig is right, there is an uptick in assaults, and that is a reason for concern. We need to fight that, but we need to not make that lead us into a war on cops kind of rhetoric that people like Donald Trump and Ted Cruz and Scott Walker, among others, have been indulging in.
Let me go back to Mario Lagarza with the Los Angeles Times. You and I are in a position of trying to mediate these discussions and present people with information. What do we need to know from the LAPD that we don't know now? Craig Lawley says, and he's right, that these investigations often take a long, long time. Is there more information that they could reveal, do you think, safely without compromising the investigations?
Yes, I think so. And I'd like to say something also about the context in which this particular case is unfolding. It's not only are we having this national discussion about race and policing, but locally there was already a growing unease about over the killing of unarmed folks in Los Angeles, as well as nationwide. So far this year, this number 18, which is the same amount of people killed in interactions with police as last year. So there's just been this demand for public discussion, which has to be, by its nature and by law, we understand, somewhat limited. But within those limits, there are ways that our elected officials can engage and talk about police tactics in general, getting out in front of incidents rather than acting defensively as the case unfolds. This video was a perfect opportunity because the police department knew about it last week to engage the public, to talk about policing and how hard it is. Because, you know, there's this narrative that, you know, that the public is fearful of police. And there might be a little unease, but I think in general, people want to be behind police officers. We give them extraordinary powers, and we believe in them. We just want to hear the justifications. We don't want to be shut out of the discussions. We'd like to hear both the good and the bad, and to be partners. And we can't be partners when the public is shut out and not engaged in the small ways that we could be.
Craig Lawley, would it reassure the public, do you think, if the department at least identified the person who was killed in this incident and said a little bit more about the circumstances that apparently surrounded this incident, which has caused a lot of concern?
Well, I don't know why the police department is holding the person's name. Maybe it's they haven't located the next of kin yet. I have no idea. So there could be a legitimate reason why that information about the person that got killed is they haven't released it. So we have to stand down on that because there might be a good reason. As far as getting the information out, we the department does a pretty good job. I know the media. The problem is the media a lot spins this stuff, and they want the information like right now. Because I know that because they call me all the time. They want it right now, and sometimes we can't release information because there is an ongoing investigation, even though we know a lot of the information. So I get both sides of this. I understand the need to know by the public. I also understand that the media wants it because sometimes they want to sensationalize it because they want to spin it into a bad thing. And I get that because I deal with both sides of that. I've had stories spun on me that were totally taken out of context. So I get that part, too.
Okay, well, what about the video we're talking about here? Mario Garza said earlier that it shows a gun in the car that's following the police car in the video, but apparently the people who made the video say that it wasn't a real gun, it wasn't a loaded gun, it was a prop. If that's the case, shouldn't the LAPD be able to figure that out?
Well, I can't tell you that because I just saw the video recently, and of course the suspect is going to say stuff like that. But you know what? Who knows the truth? Because he's saying it after the fact, after he was arrested. Of course he's going to say it's a toy gun. I mean, but what were his intentions when he was following the officer? Obviously, we can both agree and all agree that he was an idiot for doing something like that and putting it on YouTube, because eventually we got some pretty good detectives that were going to find out who was doing this in the first place.
Okay, YouTube, so, I should point out, is where this originally turned up. But Professor Armour, back to you. What do you think the police department needs to do at this point and can do without compromising the investigation?
Be as transparent as possible. That's one of the key things that's come out over the last couple of years. We do have a governmental organization, the police force, and they're responsive to the democratic will. They act under color of law. They speak for all of us. They act in our name. Any wrongdoing they do, we are complicit in. So we need transparency from them. We need accountability from them. So they need to strive to do that as much as possible. And I'm very sympathetic to these officers. You know, I might have responded the same way if it came through my window and I was in a heightened state of anxiety because I'd heard this narrative that I'm under attack. And so maybe another thing to do is to reveal the true facts that the police assaults lethal assaults have dramatically dropped over the last 50 years, that it isn't the most dangerous job in the world to do, and that actually being a citizen of about 12 cities exposes you to a higher risk of death than being a police officer. So de-escalating so that we can have more community trust and more community building between police force and community members is key.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much for being with us. We'll see how long it takes to find out more about what happened last Saturday night. Jody Armour, again, law professor at USC. Craig Lawley, the president of the Los Angeles Police Protective League. Mariel Garza, the editorial writer at the Los Angeles Times. Thanks to you all.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Pleasure being here.
Remember, you can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, Democrats put gun control back on the front burner. That's on To the Point.